This is Fresh Air. I'm Margot Adler, sitting in for Terry Gross. Billy Bob Thornton first became widely known for the 1996 film Sling Blade, which he wrote, directed, and starred in. He also co-wrote and starred in One False Move, received an Academy Award nomination for his supporting role in A Simple Plan, directed All the Pretty Horses, and co-wrote The Gift. His film Monster's Ball is currently in theaters, and his films Bandits and The Man Who Wasn't There have been recently released on video and DVD. Terry Gross spoke with him after the release of Monster's Ball. Thornton plays a corrections officer at a state prison in a small rural town in Georgia. He heads the team that handles the execution of prisoners on death row. His son has recently started to work on the team. They are preparing to execute an African-American prisoner. Thornton plays a racist, but he takes his job very seriously, particularly the ritual surrounding the condemned prisoner's final hours. In this scene, he's at a bar talking to his son, who made a mistake during the preparations for the execution.
It's when it gets time for us to do it, you know. You can't mess up. That goes for me, too, and the rest of them. You ain't no different than us. You can't screw it up. In England, they go as far as to give a guy a party the night before. Call it the Monster's Ball. They don't want no lawyer, no preacher, anything like that around, so it's just you and me. Like I said, you can't think about what he did or anything else about him. It's a job. We have to do our job right.
When Terry spoke with Billy Bob Thornton earlier this year, she asked him to describe the place where he grew up.
I grew up in two towns. Until I was 8 years old, I lived in a town called Alpine, Arkansas, which is out in the middle of nowhere. It's in the woods. There's not really a town. It's just kind of this valley between all these mountains. And we were sort of the only literate people there. My grandmother had been a school teacher in the old days, like the one-room schoolhouse thing. And my father was going to college on the GI Bill. He'd been in the Korean War. So we lived with my grandmother until I was, like I said, about nine years old. And my grandfather was a retired forestry worker, and he killed what we ate, pretty much, you know. Mm-hmm. Squirrel, possum, raccoon, you know, he would make turtle soup, all kind of stuff. We had no electricity, no running water. We had coal oil lamps, all that kind of thing. And my friends in California usually don't believe that. I mean, they think that that's only from the 1800s or something. You know, kids who are raised in Los Angeles, they just don't get that whole deal.
How old were you when you got electricity?
Well, when we moved into this other town of like 9,000 or 10,000 people when I was in the third grade. That's when things started to... to us, it was like we'd moved to New York or something, you know.
Now, your mother is a psychic. And that apparently was the inspiration for your movie, The Gift. You wrote the screenplay. It starred Cate Blanchett as a mother and psychic who investigates a murder in her town that hits very close to home. What kind of abilities did your mother have, or does she have?
When I was growing up, you know, we got a lot of flack. I think it's in the movie, actually, about the kids getting a bunch of guff at school for it. People would call my mother a witch and things like that. And then a lot of people just dismiss it. But at the same time, everybody in town would come to see my mother, but they didn't necessarily want anybody to know that. So they would, I mean, especially men, they would see her in secret, you know, wouldn't want anybody to know that they did something as crazy or sissy-like as to go to a psychic. I mean, it was a very sort of redneck, male-oriented kind of society that I grew up in. But the thing about ESP, which is what my mother has, is it's not the way people think. You don't go to her and say, "Hey, am I going to meet a tall, handsome stranger?" And she says, "Yes, and it's going to be in October." You go and you talk to her. In other words, she feels things about people. She has instincts about people, and she will tell you when she gets around to it. But you can't just ask her a question and say, "Hey, is this thing going to happen?" she may not have that information for you, but she may have something else for you. Like, she'll be talking to you and she'll say, so have you been thinking about buying a new car? And you'll say, no, I don't think so. Not really. And then you'll say, so anyway, what about this big business deal? You think it's going to come through? And she'll say, well, you know, it could. It definitely could. You're sure you're not thinking about buying a new car? Well, no, I haven't been. And then 2 days later, somebody calls this person up and says, hey, listen, I got this great GTO for sale, you know, and they buy this car. I mean, it happens that way,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, you called your movie about a psychic, The Gift. Did you grow up thinking that your mother had a gift and that certain talents were just gifts? There were things that you were just given. They came with you, and it was up to you to decide how to use it. But either you had that gift or you didn't. And did you think of yourself as having a gift?
Yes, but to answer the first part of it, I did think that people are born with gifts, absolutely. And I never really questioned all that. I always thought that if you had to try very hard to do something, it wasn't worth doing. And I still feel that to a certain degree. And people always talk about hard work and perseverance, but I think that the people with the creative side of the brain, I think those people are the ones, I mean, it was pretty obvious, they're the ones who are always daydreaming, they usually don't make good grades, they're always like, you know, they always have a bunch of weird things like, you know, well, like I've got phobias and different things like that. Usually just the more eccentric people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other people who are very practical, very hardworking, and that kind of thing. That was the world that I never quite understood. And although, I mean, both worlds obviously are valid and everything, but I just never related to that world. I always thought that you can either do things or you can't do them, you know? And I look at it that way, and like, for instance, in marriage or relationships, you know, people always say, well, you know, marriage is hard work. My marriage is really not hard work. I've been married before when it wasn't that it was hard work, it's just that it was wrong, you know?
Right, right, right.
It just wasn't the right place to be. And there was no work to it. It was like, well, this is not the right thing. I shouldn't be here, and they shouldn't be here either.
You mentioned phobias.
Right.
If you don't mind talking about it, what are some of your phobias, and how do they affect your gifts? Considering your gifts include writing and acting, do the phobias interfere with those gifts?
Well, the phobias don't necessarily interfere, particularly when I did the movie Bandits. It was helpful. Because I played a guy with phobias. But, you know, my phobias aren't really that much of a hindrance in my professional life or anything. I have a fear of antique furniture, certain kinds of antique furniture that I can't be around. I can be around.
Wait. not a common fear. What's the problem with antique furniture?
Well, I just get creeped out by it. I can't be around it. And there's a lot of people have this sort of simplistic idea about what that is. They think, well, it's a past life thing, and you know, something weird happened to you at a certain time, and you know, whatever. Which I don't doubt that it's a past life thing. I mean, one friend of mine said maybe I was beaten to death with an antique chair, but.
Excuse me for laughing.
Oh, no, it's fine. You know, I don't know exactly what it is. It involves food, though. I can't eat around antique furniture. That's the main way it affects me. But anything Asian, I'm okay with. Like, if something is, like, centuries and centuries old, if it's Asian, I'm okay with it. But if it's, like, French or English or Scottish or something like that, I get so creeped out, I can't describe it. Like, my worst nightmare is like a castle with velvet draperies and things like that.
So it sounds like a Vincent Price movie to me.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. I can't be in a Vincent Price movie. I have an unnatural fear of Benjamin Disraeli's hair.
Strange, but...
Yes. Yeah. Strange, but true.
Billy Bob Thornton talking with Terry Gross. We'll continue after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry's conversation with Billy Bob Thornton. His films Bandits and The Man Who Wasn't There have just been released on home video and DVD.
The film you were really noticed for was Sling Blade. in which you played is mentally challenged the right word now? You played a mentally challenged man released from an institution after serving 25 years for killing his mother and her lover. As you made clear when you hosted Saturday Night Live, everyone imitates you doing that part. How did you develop the voice and the character? You wrote the story, in fact, before the movie was made. You had a short film based on the same character, and I think you did him in a one-man show also.
Right. Yeah, the first thing I did was the one-man show. I'd written just the beginning, kind of what was in the short film that I did in the one-man show. I did that long monologue in the beginning there. It's based on life experience is really what it's based on, all of it. I mean, you know, the character of Carl in Sling Blade is based on a couple of different people. And I wasn't even conscious that it was based on them when I was writing it so much. It's like later on, it's like, oh, wow, you know. Matter of fact, my mother pointed out to me that part of that was like this guy that was in Alpine, you know. There was a guy who was kept up back of his family's house, and they, like, fed him sort of like a dog, you know.
Huh.
But the voice came about when I was working on a movie for HBO. And I was in the little sort of, you might call it a dressing room that they'd provided for me. I had just a few lines in the movie. I think I had four lines. And they had peeled my head because the movie took place in the 20s. And I had this really stupid-looking haircut. And I just was in the trailer at lunch, and I was thinking, wow, you know what? I'm just a joke, you know? I mean, I was looking at myself, and I thought, I got four stupid lines on a cable movie here, you know? I'm never going to get anywhere. I was just kind of feeling sorry for myself, really. And I started making faces at myself in the mirror, you know, just to sort of, like, make it even more exaggerated. It's like, you know, it's almost like pinching a sore.
Right, you know? Right.
And so I made that face, and I started talking in that voice to myself. And it sounds insane. Maybe it is. I don't know. But that's where I came up with that part of the character, the look and the voice. And then I said that monologue to myself in the mirror that day, that whole monologue. I don't know where it came from.
Why don't we hear that monologue?
Okay.
My daddy worked down there at the sawmill down to planer mill for an old man named Dixon. But old man Dixon was a very cruel feller. Didn't treat his employees very well, didn't pay them too much of a wage, didn't pay my daddy too much of a wage. Just barely enough to get by on, I reckon. But I reckon he got by all right. They used to come out, one or the other of them. Usually my mother. Feed me pretty regular. Mm-hmm. So I know he made enough to where I could have mustard and biscuit three or four times a week. Well, old man Dixon, he had a boy. Name was Jesse Dixon. Jesse was really more cruel than his daddy was. He used to make quite a bit of sport of me when I was down there at the schoolhouse. Used to take advantage of little girls there in the neighborhood and all. They used to say that my mother was a very pretty woman. They said that quite a bit from time to time when I'd be down there at the schoolhouse. Well, I reckon you want me to get on with it and tell you what happened, so I reckon I'll tell you. I was sitting out there in the shed one evening, not doing too much.
If you're just joining us, my guest is screenwriter, director, actor, and musician Billy Bob Thornton. I want to squeeze in one other scene of yours, and this is from a movie called A Simple Plan. You starred in it. This is about three people who steal money they find at the site of a plane crash. And, you know, they're a little conflicted about it, but they go through with it, and in their attempts to cover their tracks, things go terribly bad. This is a scene where your brother is dropping you off at his house, at your house, and you're wondering how money is going to change your life. Now, you're playing somebody who's kind of mentally slow in this, and who isn't physically attractive, and you know your glasses are held together by masking tape around the nose piece.
Okay.
Hey, don't you think somebody will marry me if I'm rich?
You don't need money for that.
Hank.
Hey, come on. What about, what was her name? Carrie Richards? She liked you even though you were broke, Dick.
Well, her, yeah. That was a whole different deal. That was her friends. They pitched in $100 altogether, and bet her that she wouldn't go study with me for a month.
Jesus, Jacob, I thought you guys had a thing.
That wasn't that bad. Actually, it was kind of cool. We used to walk around together a lot, you know. Take walks, you know. And we talked about all kind of cool stuff. I held hands with her one time. We were walking around. And my hand sweated so much, I kind of had to let it go. I was nervous, I guess. But it was cool. When the month was over, she, kind of, she'd say hi to me sometimes in the hallway when I'd see her. She didn't have to do that. That was cool of her. God, Hank, you know, I've never even kissed a girl before. So, you know, if being rich will change that, I'm all for it. I don't care. I just want to feel it, you know. I just want to know what people do, you know. I don't care if it's because of the money. Heck, I'm gonna be happy now, right?
Sure you are. We all are.
Yeah, that's right. We all are.
This is a very moving scene in which the character reveals a lot about himself. Could you talk a little bit about doing this scene and not turning it into a big fireworks kind of speech, but playing it really low key?
You know, first of all, as an actor, you're trying to be realistic. And if you're talking to your brother in a car about something like that, it is going to be low key. And sometimes, you know, I mean, well, when an actor tries to make a point of something, it's like being at home pretending you're like a rock star in the mirror or something, you know. It's like that's not the way you should do it. You know, you should just kind of talk or do whatever it is, you know. And that scene, though, it was an emotional scene for me. So what I did, really, in that scene, because it was, in a sense, autobiographical. I put a couple. There were a few lines that I put in there about holding the girl's hand. It was so sweaty. I couldn't. I was embarrassed by it and stuff like that. I had a time when I was in, you know, elementary school and junior high school when it was sort of that way for me, and so that scene was very, very close to me, and. As opposed to trying to put anything more into the scene, I was actually trying to hold back because I felt a lot of emotion about it. So I was actually trying to not get emotional. So maybe that's the way it worked, mm-hmm. why it worked out that way.
One last question. What's the most ridiculous thing that's ever been written about you that wasn't true?
Well, most of the stuff that's written about me and my wife is not true. It's all either from being misquoted, from joking with people, from, you know, in print, if you joke with somebody, they don't see how your face looks at the time, or they don't, you know, mm-hmm. whatever. There's this whole thing about I'm the reincarnation of Ben Franklin, which I don't doubt, but I didn't say it in seriousness, really. I mean, I feel very close to Ben Franklin. I feel very connected to him and stuff like that, but I'm not positive I was Ben Franklin. Anyway, I think probably the most ridiculous thing written about me is that I live in a dungeon. particularly given the fact that that's like my, as I was saying earlier, my worst nightmare.
You know, some
furniture.
Castle.
Yeah. And then, you know, my blood is in this little sort of locket that my wife wears around her neck, and I have hers on one also. And from that, suddenly you're like this sort of weird blood-sucking vampire.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, and I've told people this before. If you put that in a movie, you know, if Mel Gibson gave some girl a little locket of his blood in a movie, it'd be really romantic. You do it in real life, you're a weirdo.
Billy Bob Thornton talking earlier this year with Terry Gross. His film Monsters Ball is still in theaters. Bandits and The Man Who Wasn't There have just been released on home video and DVD. I'm Margo Adler, and this is Fresh Air.